I feel like when you hear the word dictatorship, I had a very specific, almost like a cinematic image pops into your head.
Oh, absolutely. Like the classic movie villain.
Right. It's usually this totally cartoonish villain. You picture a guy in an oversized military uniform, just, weighed down by fake metal.
Barking absolute orders from a gold-plated throne.
Exactly.
Yeah.
While everyone in the room just mindlessly obeys out of pure terror. And I mean, it's a compelling movie trope because it's simple, right?
It is, yeah. But the reality is, well, it's so much more complicated.
And honestly,
So
the reality is a lot more terrifying because it is so incredibly systematic.
it truly is. That cartoon villain caricature we all hold on to, it just completely obscures how these regimes actually function on like a Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah, the day-to-day stuff.
Right. It blinds us to the daily mechanics, the endless compromises, and really the intricate bureaucracy that keeps a single person in power. If you only look at the guy at the top, you completely miss the massive machinery grinding away underneath them.
And mapping out that machinery is our exact mission for you today on this deep dive. We are entirely shattering the myth of the omnipotent solo ruler.
Which is long overdue, honestly.
Totally. So to do this, we are pulling from a massive, highly detailed comparative politics dossier. It literally dropped today, August 9, 2026.
Hot off the presses.
Yeah. It's titled Dictatorship System of Power Report.pdf, published by the American newspaper and American TV. It's this incredibly comprehensive look at the systems of power behind global autocracies.
It's a dense read, but so fascinating.
It really is. Our goal here is to uncover the hidden playbook that keeps these regimes running. We're going to explore why dictators hold these elaborate elections they already know they'll win, and how modern technology, rather than just creating like Big Brother, is forcing them to completely change their strategy.
Yeah, to start unpacking all that machinery, we really first have to reevaluate our baseline definition of the word itself.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because I feel like we all think we know what a dictator is.
Right, but a dictatorship is best understood not simply by the personality of the dictator, but by the structural absence of something very specific.
Which is what?
Namely, the absence of any institutional mechanism to remove them from office. It's a political system where the competition for governing power is completely walled off.
So no matter how bad things get, there's just no legal apparatus to fire the boss.
Exactly. You can't just vote them out, you can't impeach them.
Right.
And looking at the history of the concept gives us a really fascinating contrast. Like in the Roman Republic, a quote unquote dictator was actually a highly formalized, legal, and temporary emergency magistrate.
Wait, legal and temporary?
Yeah. If the Republic faced an existential crisis like an invading army, the Senate would literally appoint a dictator.
Oh.
They were handed maximum unchecked authority to solve the problem, and then, usually after about 6 months, they were expected to just hand the power back.
Which is wild to think about through a modern lens, right?
Totally.
The idea of saying, here is absolute unchecked power over the entire military and the state. Please make sure you return it nicely by December.
Right. It requires a level of institutional trust that just does not exist in these systems today.
It really doesn't. And, the dossier provides a really useful linguistic comparison to highlight that shift. They point to the Chinese term, dukai.
Yes, I love that example.
It's so precise. It combines the character for alone or sole with the character for to decide or rule, unilateral decision making.
It really captures the modern essence perfectly. The ability to decide political affairs without having to answer to any effective countervailing authority.
Right, so that definition brings up a massive logistical question for me. If the core concept is unilateral, absolute power, how does one single person actually control a nation of 50 or 100 million people?
It's the ultimate management problem, really.
It is. It feels like we are treating a dictator as this all-seeing god. But logically, they are more like the CEO of a highly dysfunctional, incredibly cutthroat corporation.
That is the perfect analogy.
I mean, a dictator can't personally walk door to door to collect taxes, right? They can't physically patrol every mile of the border, and they certainly can't read every single newspaper article before it goes to print.
No, of course not. They have to delegate.
Exactly.
And that corporate analogy works because power is fundamentally relational. Because a dictator cannot do everything themselves, they have to rely on agents.
Like the generals, regional bureaucrats, local police chiefs.
Exactly. And the moment you introduce agents, you run into what economists and political scientists call the principal-agent problem.
Right. I remember this from econ class.
Yeah. The ruler, the principal, needs these agents to execute their will. But those agents are human beings with their own selfish agendas, their own greed, and honestly, their own desire for survival.
They aren't robots. They want to get rich or, you know, at least avoid getting shot.
Precisely. And that dynamic leads us straight into this foundational concept highlighted in the report, developed by political scientist Ronald Wintrobe. It's called the dictator's dilemma.
Yes. I found this entire section just mind-blowing because it completely flips the script on how we view a dictator's power.
It really does.
Walk us through the mechanics of this dilemma.
So it operates as this vicious cycle. Dictators typically use violence and fear to maintain their control, right?
Literally, yeah.
But because everyone around them is terrified, the citizens and even the closest advisors engage in a behavior that scholar Timur Kuran calls preference falsification.
Preference falsification.
Yes. People systematically lie about their true feelings and beliefs in order to survive.
Okay, let me see if I'm tracking this. If I'm the Minister of Agriculture in one of these regimes.
Okay, good example.
And I know the dictator's new farming policy is causing a massive famine. I am never going to walk into his office and say, "Sir, your policy is a catastrophe and millions of people are starving."
Never. You'd be risking your own life.
Right. So instead, I'm going to walk in and say, "Congratulations, sir. The wheat harvest is up 200% and everyone loves you."
That is exactly how it plays out in practice. You flatter them. You aggressively hide the bad news.
Wow.
So the ultimate irony of the dictator's dilemma is this. The more fear and violence a ruler uses to secure their position, the less accurate information they actually receive about the state of their own country.
They successfully terrify everyone into building them a completely soundproof bubble of lies.
Exactly.
Which means they are operating completely blind to actual threats.
And being blind makes them terrible at making policy or anticipating crises.
Of course.
And to try and manage this constant lingering paranoia about who is actually loyal and who is just lying to survive, dictators change their hiring practices.
How so?
Well, they start promoting people based purely on personal loyalty rather than actual competence.
Oh, right.
Think about it. A highly competent, charismatic, intelligent general, that guy is incredibly dangerous.
Because they have the skills and the respect of the troops to potentially lead a successful coup.
Exactly. But a mediocre, slightly incompetent general who knows he only has his job because the dictator favors him, that guy is much safer.
So the dossier refers to this as turning the entire government into a loyalty machine. And the psychological weight of that on a society must be just staggering.
It hollows out the entire nation. The loyalty machine progressively degrades the state's actual capacity to function. The bureaucracy becomes hopelessly risk-averse.
Right, because no one wants to stick their neck out.
Exactly. No one takes initiative to fix a failing power grid or a broken healthcare system because taking initiative draws attention.
And attention gets you killed.
Yes. The state loses the ability to solve complex real-world problems because every single official, from the top ministers down to the local dog catcher, is just trying to anticipate what will please the boss rather than what will actually work.
Which, I mean, that begs a massive follow-up question. If this system creates a government that is completely dysfunctional, completely blind to reality, and managed by incompetent yes-men, how do these regimes survive for decades?
It's a great question.
Like, if they're that bad at their jobs, shouldn't they just collapse under their own weight instantly?
You'd think so, but the survival of these regimes is this delicate, really high-stakes balancing act. What's fascinating here is how the dossier outlines that autocracies rely on three interacting pillars of survival.
Three pillars.
Right. It's never just about raw violence. Relying solely on the military to point guns at people is incredibly expensive, and honestly, it's politically brittle. The three pillars they balance are coercion, co-optation, and legitimation.
Okay, so coercion is the stick. The police, the prisons, the secret police kicking down your door in the middle of the night.
Coercion is the stick, yes, but it's important to note it's not always active physical violence. Often it's just the credible threat of violence.
Like knowing they could kick your door down.
Right. It's the surveillance cameras on the street, the selective prosecution of a few high-profile dissidents just to send a message, or just that quiet, lingering fear that you could lose your job, your apartment, or your freedom if you speak out. But as we established, you can't run an entire country purely on threats. You need the second pillar. Co-optation.
And this is the transactional side of the house. The carrots.
Yes, exactly. Co-optation is about distributing the spoils of the state.
like handing out lucrative patronage jobs, massive government contracts, that sort of thing?
Exactly that. Exclusive import licenses, prime real estate. It's giving key influential people a very real material reason to want the regime to survive.
So if your entire fortune, your family status, and your immunity from prosecution depend entirely on the dictator staying in power, you are going to aggressively support that dictator.
Exactly. You are bought in.
So you've bought off the elites with monopolies on concrete, and you've terrified the masses with the secret police.
Yeah.
But at some point, you still have to convince people they actually need you, right? Which brings us to the third pillar, legitimation.
Right. Legitimation is the narrative glue. It's the story the regime tells to justify its existence to the public.
Like what kind of story?
Well, sometimes it's a sweeping ideology like communism in the 20th century. Sometimes it's intense, aggressive nationalism, you know, protecting the homeland from supposed foreign enemies.
Sure.
Sometimes it's religious authority or even just a pragmatic claim of economic competence. The narrative is always basically, we might be tough, but we are the only ones standing between you and absolute chaos. We keep the economy growing and we keep you safe.
Okay, but I want to push back on something in that structure for a second, specifically regarding the coercion pillar.
Okay, go for it.
There was a section in the dossier about who the dictator actually uses that coercion against, and it really caught me off guard.
Ah, you're talking about the threat models.
Yeah, because when we watch the news, we always see footage of mass public protests, thousands of citizens marching in the streets demanding change. But the report argues the masses aren't the primary concern. Isn't the real threat to the dictator sitting right down the hall from them?
Yes. You've hit on Milan Zvolik's dual threat theory.
Dual threat theory.
Right. Dictators do face a threat from the masses below, sure, but they face a much more immediate, statistically probable, and dangerous threat from their own insiders, the elites.
Because the elites already have the keys to the castle.
Exactly that. The masses have overwhelming numbers, but they face a monumental coordination problem.
Right. How do you get a million terrified citizens to all show up at the same plaza at the same time without the secret police finding out?
It's incredibly difficult. Elite insiders, on the other hand, the military commanders, the intelligence chiefs, the party bosses, they don't have a coordination problem.
They already have the group chat going.
Exactly. They already possess the weapons, they control the administrative levers of the state, and they manage the secure communication networks.
Yeah.
If a group of generals decides to move against the dictator on a Monday, they can have them overthrown or assassinated by Tuesday.
Okay, I need to stop here, because this leads to a phenomenon the report calls coup-proofing, introduced by James Quinlivan. And I'm genuinely struggling with the logic of this one.
It is counterintuitive, for sure.
The report says dictators will deliberately, intentionally weaken their own military's battlefield effectiveness, just to prevent them from organizing a coup.
Yes, they will.
But if you are a dictator and you likely have hostile neighboring countries who might want to invade you, hobbling your own army sounds like an absolute death sentence. How do they possibly justify that level of risk?
I mean, it sounds totally suicidal from a national security perspective, absolutely. But you have to shift your perspective to the dictator's primary overarching goal,
which is just personal survival.
Exactly. They are trading national state capacity for palace security. Because the army is the only entity with the physical force to remove them instantly, the dictator has to make sure the army can never coordinate internally.
Wow. What does that coup-proofing actually look like on the ground? Like, how do you ruin your own army on purpose?
Well, it takes several forms. First, you split the command structures into a tangled mess. You ensure that the general who controls the tanks does not control the fuel supply, and neither of them controls the ammunition.
Oh, that's wild.
And you force them to communicate only through your office.
Right.
Second, you constantly rotate your commanders. Imagine a general is stationed in the north. He spends 2 years getting to know his officers, building trust and loyalty.
And the dictator sees that trust as a massive threat.
Exactly. So he moves that general to the south, surrounded by complete strangers. The unit is now terribly ineffective at fighting a war, but that general can no longer launch a coup.
You also see them create those massive, heavily armed presidential guards or Republican guards that exist entirely outside the regular military chain of command, right?
Yep.
Answering only to the ruler.
Yes, you create parallel militaries basically to watch each other. The logic is brutal but sound. If your armed forces are too fragmented and distrustful of each other to efficiently coordinate an attack on a foreign enemy.
They're also too fragmented to coordinate an attack on the presidential palace.
Exactly.
That is a stunning level of institutional paranoia. Understanding that elite management is the true life-or-death game for a dictator, that suddenly clarifies another huge mystery for me.
Which is?
Here's where it gets really interesting. Why do these regimes bother keeping democratic-looking institutions around at all?
Yes.
Like, you have absolute power. You've crippled your own army so they can't overthrow you. Why on earth are you bothering to draft a constitution? Why are you holding parliamentary elections when literally everyone in the country knows the ballot boxes are stuffed before the polls even open?
Right.
I always assumed it was just cheap window dressing for the United Nations. But the dossier suggests it serves a vital internal function.
It is far more than international window dressing, yeah. Political scientists Stephen Levitsky and Lucan Way actually coined the term competitive authoritarianism to describe this. It's systems that maintain the facade of democracy to achieve authoritarian ends.
You know, while reading this, an analogy that kept coming to my mind was a corporate franchise performance review.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. It feels like holding an election isn't about giving the citizens a voice at all. It's the dictator testing their regional managers. It's a directive saying, show me you control your local territory well enough to deliver a fabricated 90% turnout for the ruling party without sparking a massive riot.
That is a very astute way to view it. Elections in these systems discipline the local officials. If a regional governor fails to deliver the expected landslide, the dictator knows that governor is weak and needs to be replaced.
Wow.
But these fake elections serve other crucial functions, too. They act as a massive countrywide surveillance tool.
Really? How so?
Well, even in a rigged election, you can track where the protest votes are coming from. If a specific industrial district suddenly registers a 20% vote for the opposition, the regime now knows exactly where to direct the secret police and where to cut state funding.
Wow. It also seems like a brutal way of projecting dominance, just psychologically.
Oh, absolutely.
Like forcing millions of people to stand in line to vote in an election everyone knows is a sham. It signals absolute invincibility. It tells the population, look at what I can make you do.
It demonstrates that resistance is entirely futile. And, you know, this same twisted logic applies to the courts. The dossier makes a really vital distinction between the rule of law and rule by law.
Break that down for us, because those sound completely identical.
They do, but they are polar opposites. Rule of law is what we expect in a democracy. The law sits above everyone, and it applies equally to the ruler and the citizen.
Right.
Rule by law means the ruler uses the legal system as a weapon against their enemies. Modern autocrats, they rarely send thugs to break a journalist's legs in an alleyway anymore. It's too messy.
Bad PR.
Exactly. Instead, they send a team of tax inspectors. They revoke the broadcasting license over a minor paperwork error. They find an obscure zoning violation to shut down a dissident's business.
Ah, because technically on paper, you didn't arrest a political opponent. You just arrested a guy who committed tax fraud.
Yes, and that makes it incredibly difficult for the opposition to rally around them as a political martyr. It sanitizes and routinizes the repression.
So that explains the formal institutions, the courts, and the fake elections.
No.
But I have to ask you about the deeply informal, honestly bizarre stuff.
Okay.
The personality cults. We've all seen the footage. The 60-foot golden statues forcing school children to sing anthems about how the supreme leader single-handedly invented the hamburger or, you know, doesn't have a digestive system.
Right. The really extreme stuff.
Yeah. We tend to laugh at that stuff in the West as pure, unhinged narcissism. But the dossier claims this is actually a highly calculated, rational mechanism.
It is absolutely a rational tool, and it ties directly back to managing the elites we discussed earlier. A personality cult operates as a very costly, very public elite loyalty test.
Okay, how does forcing someone to sing a song operate as a test?
Well, look at it from the dictator's paranoid perspective. If you order your top general or your finance minister to agree with this sensible, logical policy, like building a new highway, you learn nothing about their actual loyalty.
Because it's just a good idea anyway.
Right. You don't know if they are agreeing with you because they are devoted to you or just because building a highway is genuinely a good idea.
Oh, wow. I see where this is going.
Right. But if you force that powerful, highly educated, proud general to stand on national television and publicly praise an entirely ridiculous, disastrous policy.
Yeah.
Or you force them to attribute a magical, godlike feat to you, That is a visible, humiliating ritual of submission.
The absurdity is the point.
Exactly.
You are forcing them to publicly burn their own credibility.
Yeah.
You are destroying your inner circle's dignity, so they have absolutely nowhere else to go. No one else will ever respect them again.
And that is a massive signal of loyalty. The more absurd the claim they have to publicly endorse, the stronger the proof that their fate is entirely tied to yours.
That is so twisted.
And crucially, if a minister hesitates or refuses to participate in the absurd ritual, the dictator instantly knows who the threat is and can purge them before they organize a plot.
That is incredibly dark, but fascinating. Now, we've been talking heavily about these physical, almost analog forms of control, managing generals, building statues, holding fake rallies. But bringing this firmly into the 2026 reality we live in.
The digital age.
Yeah, with the rise of AI, omniprism, facial recognition, mass data collection, hasn't modern technology basically handed dictators a master key for total control? It feels like the dictator's dilemma that lack of accurate information could be completely solved today by just having an AI read everyone's text messages and flag the dissidents.
It is so tempting to think that. And technology has undeniably altered the cost structure of mass surveillance. I mean, it's cheaper than ever to watch people. But the dossier firmly pushes back on the idea of a technological magic wand. They define digital authoritarianism as a socio-technical system.
Socio-technical, meaning the algorithm is useless without the human element.
Exactly. An AI facial recognition system that can identify a million protesters in real time is politically meaningless on its own. It only matters if human institutions, the riot police, the courts, the budgetary committees, are organized, loyal, and willing to act on that data. If the AI flags a protester, but the local police force is corrupt, underpaid, or sympathetic to the protest, and they refuse to make the arrest, the multi-billion dollar tech infrastructure is useless.
The humans still have to actually swing the baton.
Yes. Furthermore, AI introduces the massive problem of false positives. If a paranoid algorithm starts flagging genuinely loyal elites as potential traitors based on a misunderstood phone call, the dictator might start purging their own supporters.
Oh, wow.
That accidentally triggers the exact elite fragmentation and panic they spent all their time trying to avoid.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
At its core, it remains a human system fraught with human errors. But the way these regimes manipulate information has fundamentally shifted, hasn't it? The dossier highlights a transition from classic fear dictators to modern spin dictators.
Yes, that's a brilliant framework developed by Sergei Guriev and Daniel Treisman. Classic fear dictators think of Stalin, or Pinochet relied on comprehensive brute force censorship and mass terror.
Right.
But in a modern globalized world, that strategy carries a devastating economic cost. It completely isolates you. If you aggressively block all outside information and terrorize your workforce, you kill innovation, foreign investment, and economic dynamism.
And as we covered earlier, they need a thriving economy to generate the money required to buy off the elites with those import licenses and contracts.
Precisely. So modern spin dictators use a much more sophisticated strategy. Selective censorship combined with information flooding.
Information flooding.
Right. Instead of trying to put a firewall around the entire internet, which angers the middle class and slows down business, they swamp the zone.
What does that actually look like for a citizen in 2026? Just drowning the truth in absolute garbage.
It looks like weaponized exhaustion. The regime uses massive bot networks, state-sponsored influencers, and algorithmic manipulation.
Okay, give me an example.
Imagine an opposition leader calls for a protest on Saturday. Instead of blocking the internet, the regime's bots flood social media with conflicting rumors. One rumor says the protest is actually on Sunday. Another says the protest is a trap set by the secret police. Another accuses the opposition leader of embezzling funds.
Oh, my God.
Meanwhile, the state pushes endless, hyper-engaging entertainment and viral videos to distract everyone else.
So the goal isn't to convince the public that the dictator is a flawless saint. The goal is just to make basic coordination impossible.
Yes. If you flood the zone with so much noise, contradiction, and manufactured outrage, people simply don't know who or what to trust anymore.
They just give up.
Exactly. They get exhausted, cynical, and eventually they just disengage from politics entirely. You don't need to spend resources arresting a citizen if they are too confused and apathetic to even leave their house.
It's terrifyingly effective. And the data backs this up. The Freedom House 2025 report cited in the dossier notes a 15th consecutive annual decline in global internet freedom.
15 years.
Yeah, the digital crackdown is real and it is expanding. So what does this all mean for the lifespan of these regimes? Because despite the information flooding, the co-optation, the coup-proofing, autocracies do still eventually collapse.
Mm.
What is the fundamental Achilles heel of this entire system?
The ultimate vulnerability stems from the exact same dynamic that makes them appear so impenetrable in the short term: extreme personalization.
Right.
When a ruler spends decades systematically destroying all independent institutions, purging competent rivals, and centralizing every single lever of power around their own personal whim, they create massive long-term fragility. The ultimate crisis point for any autocracy is succession.
Because the one thing a dictator can't outlaw is human mortality. Eventually, they will age, get sick, or die.
And that is when the House of Cards falls. Think about the contrast with a democracy. Democracies institutionalize uncertainty of who will govern. We don't know who will win the next election, but they make the process of transferring power highly predictable and stable.
Right, there's a scheduled handover.
But dictatorships are the exact mirror opposite. It is absolutely certain who governs today, but the process of succession is a terrifying, chaotic unknown. Because there are no independent courts, no trusted electoral laws, and no neutral arbiters, there is simply no mechanism for a peaceful transfer of power.
And a dictator who has spent 30 years making enemies can't exactly just retire to a beach house in Malibu and take up painting.
Almost never. If they step down, they lose their absolute immunity. They live in justifiable fear of prison, the confiscation of their family's wealth, or outright assassination by the very people they oppressed for decades.
Right.
So they're incentivized to cling to power until their dying breath. And when they finally do die or become incapacitated, the vacuum often triggers a massive systemic collapse or a violent, bloody struggle among the elites. The entire system was custom built only for one person, so it basically dies with them.
Now, before we wrap up this deep dive, there's a crucial flip side to this research that we absolutely have to touch on, bringing the mechanics of this right into our own backyards.
Yes, very important.
Because this dossier isn't just a history lesson about countries that are already full-blown dictatorships. It pulls heavily from the VDEM 2026 and International IDEA 2025 data on a global trend called autocratization.
Right.
And I want to be super clear here for the listener. This isn't a left-wing or right-wing thing.
Not at all.
What is so striking about this data is that we see this structural playbook being used globally, entirely independent of political ideology. It's about the universal mechanics of consolidating power.
That is a vital distinction to make. Autocratization is the process of how modern established democracies erode and backslide. And it rarely happens the way it does in the movies, with tanks suddenly rolling down the Capitol streets in a midnight military coup.
Right, it's quieter.
Today, democracies die through what political scientist Nancy Bermeo calls executive aggrandizement.
Executive aggrandizement. It's the slow, creeping, frog in boiling water stuff.
Yes. It's a cumulative, seemingly legal, gradual erosion of checks and balances. An elected leader comes into office claiming a populist mandate to, quote unquote, fix the broken system. They start by subtly weakening the courts. Maybe they change the mandatory retirement age for judges so they can suddenly appoint 5 new loyalists.
Wow.
Then they quietly restructure the independent election boards. They use those obscure regulatory and tax laws we talked about earlier to harass independent media owners until they sell their networks to a billionaire ally of the regime.
There's that rule by law again, using the system to break the system.
And that is what makes it so insidious. Any single one of those steps, in isolation, might be easily justified to the public as a technical reform or a necessary anti-corruption measure.
It looks fine.
It looks survivable. The public doesn't panic. But the danger lies in the interaction of all these subtle changes. Once the courts, the media, and the electoral referees are simultaneously compromised, the system loses the capacity to check the executive.
And then it's too late.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The competitive democratic system is slowly hollowed out from the inside piece by piece until one day you wake up and realize that voting the ruling party out of power has become practically impossible.
Wow. Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. For you listening, we've completely dismantled that Hollywood myth of the omnipotent solo ruler. We've seen how they are actually trapped in the dictator's dilemma, managing a dysfunctional loyalty machine and blinded by the very fear they create.
It's quite the paradox.
It really is. We explored why fake elections and bizarre personality cults are actually highly rational, calculated tools for testing elite submission. And we've seen how the 2026 reality favors the spin dictator who exhausts the public by flooding the zone with noise, rather than just relying on brute force.
It truly is a dynamic, constantly shifting ecosystem of power and paranoia, not just a single villain sitting on a throne.
As we close out, I want to leave you with something to really mull over. Based on all these intricate systems of control, complicity, and psychology we've unpacked today, what is the one provocative thought our listeners should take away from this?
I want to circle back to that early concept of preference falsification. The act of systematically lying about your true beliefs just to survive or fit in a dictatorship, we know that is done at gunpoint. It is a matter of physical survival.
Right, life or death.
But I'd ask you to consider your own life in our current hyper-connected, socially pressurized digital world. How often do we engage in our own micro versions of preference falsification?
Oh, wow.
Out of a fear of social backlash, algorithmic outrage, or professional ruin, how often do we silence our true thoughts? It is worth asking if we, too, are voluntarily creating organizational spirals of silence, actively participating in building the exact kind of blind spots that eventually bring down empires.
That is a haunting and brilliant thought to end on. A system of power, no matter where it is ultimately only as strong as the truth it allows to be spoken. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
Keep questioning the systems of power around you, and we'll see you next time.